You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 46 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Matilda Siebrecht, and today I'm savouring a black vanilla tea. I thought I should try and fortify myself with something a little more caffeinated, because joining me on my tea break today is Svenja Fabian. So welcome, Svenja. And are you also drinking a tea this morning?
Yes, because this is tea break time travel and I like tea. I'm having a black tea with already little bit ahead of the time, but I don't know when this will be broadcasted. Christmas spices!
Hey! It's perfect! Oh, well, yeah. Actually, it'll be in the new year, so it's actually a bit... We're still leaving Christmas.
There, okay, after Christmas, so but then it will still be perfect.
Yeah, I love...
It's winter spices,
exactly,
actually.
Yeah, is that warm? I've got a really nice Christmas tea on my shelf, and I keep looking at it going, when's too early?
It's already getting time for it.
Yes, for people listening in, we're recording this in November. So, but excellent. And are you generally a tea drinker?
Yes, I feel like definitely.
Okay. Yeah.
Usually, when it's just a work day or something, I just stick to Earl Grey in a tea bag. Then I don't have time to whatever or
do the whole ritual.
Pages to prepare another tea or loose leaf tea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also at work, it's more handy to have tea bags.
Yes. That's
but fair. Then it definitely is the classic Earl Grey.
Yeah, with then like lemon rather than milk.
No milk in it, no.
No milk, yeah,
with Earl Grey. Just as it is.
Yeah, yeah, nice. Because I'm just curious, because obviously you are German originally, and then you're living in the Netherlands now, because the Netherlands is apparently the biggest tea-drinking country in the world, which I didn't realise. I thought it was the British. But is because I feel like here that not many people drink tea in Germany. But is that different to the region you're from?
I'm from the north of Germany and there people drink more tea. Yes,
okay.
Definitely.
Yeah, linked all together.
So yeah, also from Ostfriesland, really east, really in the north to the west of Germany, because but it's Friesland. So Westfriesland is then in the Netherlands.
Yes, which always confused me. It's like Ostfriesland in the west.
Yeah, but I think those are regions. Yeah, and then they drink the tea with rum in it.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, we could do that.
Yeah, definitely. But not now. It's early in the morning when we record this now, so no rum in my tea now.
I mean, we could call it medicinal.
Yeah, and here in the Netherlands, I think, when I go somewhere, or also with the orchestra, when we have a break and drink tea or coffee, I have the feeling that the majority of the people are drinking coffee.
Yeah.
I like coffee as well. So at least in the morning, it needs to be some of those hot beverages with caffeine in it.
Yeah.
No matter if it's coffee or black tea.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah, I started drinking the occasional coffee after I had my second little one. Weirdly, don't know what the correlation is between needing more caffeine and having another child. So yes, we're not just here to talk about tea, even though I think we could probably have a whole episode talking about hot beverages. So I've invited Svenja on because she is, I think, the description sounds epic just in itself, but we're going to dive into it more. A gladiatorial reenactor or gladiatrix, right? Because female gladiator. Yeah. Although actually you've just recently officially retired, right? From the physical fighting aspect of it.
Yeah. That's true. I did it for 20 years. And the reason is that I was always interested in the Romans.
Yeah.
And I also practiced martial arts. I practiced Wing Chun. And as a kid, I did judo.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So martial arts was always somehow in my interest. And then I thought, I just want to do something with fighting. And since there weren't any female legionaries, eventually back then there was already a gladiator group in Hamburg, but they were just a sidekick or something of a legionary group.
Okay,
and
like a reenactment.
In the end, I really have to say the gladiatura is much more interesting for a martial artist than a legionary. Because if legionary groups do any like fights or something at all, it's more like a line fight. They have to keep the line.
Okay.
And they don't fight these duels as gladiators do.
Yeah.
And as a gladiator, you are just you and your opponent.
Yeah.
And that group, and also the group which I founded later on, we always did it, trained it. You do training at a martial art, you train certain movements, how to handle the weapons, and did some drills and these things.
Yeah.
There are also groups around which choreograph their fights.
Kind of like more MMA, like a stage fight. Whatever it is. Yeah, yeah.
And I think that always you see it when it's choreographed, and I think it's like overacting or something. So to me, it doesn't look right. It looks more like a kind of a comedy of the actual thing.
Yeah.
But okay, that's my opinion. So not to talk against those groups.
But also, so, I mean, because I guess most people, and I must say, I, even though I am the director of the Experimental Archaeology Society, and we have a lot of members who do reenactment, I must say I know very little about it, especially something like gladiatorial fighting. And I guess most people listening in, like me, the first thing you think about is something like the film Gladiator, or, you know, something like that. What actually is it that you do as a gladiatorial reenactor? Are you, like, demonstrating for museums? Is it more like a sports club? Like, what's the sort of community aspect of it? What is it actually?
Yeah, we do it actually as a kind of a sport, the training, and then we present this sport with the presentation and moderation at museums, festivals, and or at schools.
Okay.
They also ask us for either if they have like a special day at school, like there's this one gymnasium in Hamburg. They always have a Latin day because they are specialized in old languages, and they have, of course, teach their students Latin. So they have a Latin day, and then we come there for this day. And I don't know, it's usually
making it exciting.
And luckily we have one member in our group. He's a kindergarten teacher. So he knows how to handle different type of students, those who try to make fun of out of it, or are impatient, or very loud, noisy, not sitting still until it's their turn to practice. We always try to give them like little exercises so that they could practice. And usually the majority of the kids, they enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, I could imagine. Like, I mean, I'm sure, everyone turns into a little kid probably when watching it as well. It's that classic thing. Okay, that's really interesting. Because, and is it something that you have, like, so you have the demonstration aspect of it, the kind of educational aspect of it, but do you also have, if it's sort of like a sports club type thing, do you have kind of competitions or, you know?
That's really something which came up now in the recent years. That there are some gladiator groups trying to make a tournament, which is not historical at all. No. Gladiator fights were only, they were just fighting against each other, and that was it. And then you had your score, you won a fight or you lost it with the missio. And there was never in ancient Rome a tournament of gladiators, or like if you would like compare it with today's boxing events, where one boxer boxes one fight at a fight night, but against a certain opponent, and he becomes champion because he won so many fights with that boxing club or what organization or whatsoever. No, we don't know this, that it was like this for gladiators. I don't think so. They were just really hired for this particular show, and they showed their duels. And then, so this is something really new and modern, which some gladiator groups try. And they try still to keep this, that only the historical pairings can fight against each other. So they have, if the gladiator groups join, they have like one part of the tournament is then all sicutores against the retiarii.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So they're like particular roles or?
Yeah.
Okay.
There are certain roles of gladiators. So they try to keep them assigned to those roles.
Okay. And is the roles related to like weapons or like level or ability? Or
no, weapons, the equipment, okay. Yes. Okay. So the Retiarius is the net fighter with the net and trident and a, what's it called?
To be fair, you could say anything right now and I'd be like, yeah.
No, and his opponent was always the Secutor with the large scutum. That's a huge rectangular shield, is also known from the Roman legionaries. And the Secutor then had as an offensive weapon only a short sword. The sword of a gladiator was later on in, at least in the imperial time, much shorter than a legionary sword. They wanted to get the gladiators more into a close fight. And then it's even harder to hit and also to avoid the being hit. So it triggered more really the swordsmanship of the gladiators.
Oh, interesting. So they were sort of forced to use a different kind of weapon and then that affected the technique that they would use.
Yeah, they were specialized. It's not known exactly how they did it, if they sorted them in the beginning when they bought slaves or whatsoever into certain categories. But I think it could be also that all the new gladiators just did their basic training and maybe tried out long weapons like the Hoplomachus fighting with the stabbing lance and or the Retiarius with the trident, or if they are also the Thracian with the bended sword, which has a bend in it, like a falx, something like that. So that the gladiatorial trainers might maybe decide later on who would be fitted into which category.
Okay.
So that,
that's so it's not almost like
known.
A football team.
It's really an assumption.
I'm just picturing like the first training, like it's almost like a football training, you know, and you have the team and then they're like, right, you're clearly like center forward or whatever it is. And you're goalkeeper and your thing is like, right, you look good with a trident. Let's give you the trident. And you're clearly good at, I don't know, short swords, so we'll give you this one. So that's really fascinating. What was your specialism?
My role was the proof, because that's based on the relief from Halicarnassos, which is now on a display at the British Museum. It shows two female gladiators in a basic or beginning fighting stance facing each other. Mm-hmm. But it shows already the result of the fight.
Yeah.
Because it has in Greek the words written over it that the fight ended in a draw.
Yeah.
And it also has the names of the two fighters written beneath. One is called Amazon and the other one Achillea, being a female version of the name Achilles.
Achilles,
So
she wearing good boots.
Yeah.
They cover up
her. And they have the equipment. They are similarly equipped, both the same way. So that was a typical thing for the provocator, that the provocator fought always against another woman.
Okay.
And in the beginning, I thought it also very practical, because the provocator is the only gladiator class of having breast protection. So they wear a pectorale, and in the beginning, when you are not that good yet, as a female, came in handy.
Right, I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, but later on, I didn't mind really fighting as a Mormillo, as a Secutor, because our group in the beginning also was very small, and later on, I also got the equipment of, or the helmet, then it was, and the shield. So the sword always remained the same, short sword. Later on, I also fought Mormillo and Secutor, and then I didn't wear the breastplate anymore. It's just I had a spruphium wrapped around, and that thing, that's just, how really to wrap this thing, you don't see from any, whatever, mosaics. There's this very famous mosaic from Piazza Armerina in Sicily, which shows women doing some sports. And they were bikini briefs and this scrofium, this breastband.
Okay.
But how it is wrapped, you cannot see, of course, in a mosaic.
Yeah.
So,
Like, it was sports bra.
Yeah, it was trying to kind of trying to find out how to wrap this, that it really stays up yeah. and sits tight. And I found a way that it sits tighter than any sports bra.
There you go. Nice. That's yeah. that's something that you never really think about, that when you're trying to do gladiatorial training, the main thing you learn is how they would have secured a potential sports bra in the age of time.
Yeah. So well, in the nice. End, yeah, that's...
Yeah, no, that sounds really interesting. I want to talk more about the sort of gladiatrix side of things as well, but we're going to have a quick break to top up our tea, and then we will be right back. Welcome back, everyone. Hopefully the teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So I'm curious, we were just sort of talking about added complications of being a female gladiatorial reenactor. And I'm curious, I mean, you were mentioning that there aren't that many women involved in the reenactment sort of sphere in terms of gladiatorial fighting. Has this changed since you started?
Definitely. In the beginning, there were two other females in Germany. Yeah, because I started in Germany.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, it was also ridiculed by other people, not only men. Of course, men also thought, oh, that didn't exist.
Yeah.
But also other women who also weren't aware of that, that existed. And yeah, I did, of course, my research and I knew that there were female gladiators. So
yeah.
But luckily that changed, and also more women are joining the groups.
That's
so
good.
Yeah, of course, now it's more women, like the ratio of women and men in the group or how we present them is nowadays not matching the ancient ratio anymore, because back then in ancient Rome, it was really something, exceptional. It wasn't that often. So it was kind of, when you showed female gladiators, it was also adding to the spice of your show.
Ah, okay. They were like a special deal.
Special thing, yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. And of course, nowadays, we don't exclude women to participate at all. And
Yeah. And do you have a lot of, I mean, you mentioned, for example, you go to schools and things. I mean, do you have a lot of response from like girls watching, or from people who are watching, from female sort of spectators?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Especially the girls. I remember this one school event where we went to, that when we were done, a girl came up to me and said, "Oh, you were amazing."
Yay.
It was so cute. And also I got a feedback from the teacher, female teacher who had organized this event. And she said that even she has some girls in her class with Middle Eastern background.
Oh, okay.
And that especially for those girls, we were kind of like a role model, and they saw that women can also do cool things.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Women
or
girls. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. And because you mentioned already, so we know that they definitely existed. You mentioned this relief from Halikarnassos, I think you said.
Yes.
So there are other then references. I mean, you talked about how it was a special thing to have women in your fight. So were there kind of historic records about female gladiatrix?
One is that the mayor of Ostia, that's the port, a city of Rome, that he put in his inscription that he showed a fight, or he was the first one in Ostia to show a fight of female gladiators.
Okay. Yeah.
So that, and then of course we have some literary sources mentioning in different ways. Of course, mentioning sometimes some games of Nero, of Dan, that they had female fighters, but sometimes it was also a criticism, but not only a criticism of the female fighters, but also of the male fighters. That's to say, from which class they were from, that they were people from the senatorial class were forced to fight as a gladiator. And that was something bad, because the profession of gladiator was disgraceful.
Oh, okay.
They had this stigma of being infam, it's called in Latin.
Okay.
And that deprived you from your citizen rights. For the male, it was, of course, that he could vote and these things, or run for an office himself.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in a senatorial class, it was always not only what this man did, he also brought then disgrace to the whole family. And so it was the same if a female from a senatorial glass did something. She also brought disgrace to the whole family.
So I was under the impression that all gladiators and gladiatrices were slaves that were brought, but is that not...
No, not all.
Okay.
Definitely not. There were also volunteer gladiators.
Okay.
And there is a law. Obviously, there must have been quite a lot of volunteers, because there is a law, even the beginning... Now, either the end of the first century or beginning of the BC or the beginning of the first century AD, that people under a certain age, females below 20 years and male below whatever years, I don't know the...
Five or something.
No, not that low. But below a certain age are not allowed to fight as a gladiator.
Oh.
And then, of course, this... It's the Senatus Consultum, so it was a decree of the Senate of Rome. Huh. And it said also that all from the senatorial class were not allowed to fight as a gladiator. So this age limitations referred only to people of the lower classes.
Okay, whereas, and the upper classes weren't allowed at all.
The senatorial class wasn't allowed to fight as a gladiator at all.
That's so interesting.
They really list a father, mother, brother, sister, whatsoever.
No fine
grandfather,
print, no
grandmother. They really list all the relationships, really male and female version.
That's so interesting.
So that's also an indication that it might have been also attracted to some females.
If they had to be like, no, you're not allowed, like they had to make a law about it. Indeed, that suggests that a lot of people were wanting to do it.
And also, that's also something about the gladiators, that especially for the lower classes, when you joined as a volunteer to a gladiator school, you gave up all your rights, but when you come from the lower class, they couldn't run for office
anymore.
They didn't
have
the
financial
means to do so.
And women as well, I guess, right? Women couldn't vote or anything.
Yeah,
so I guess
but they didn't care. And then also they had, at a gladiator school, 3 meals per day. They had a roof above their head. They had good medical treatment.
Nice.
Better than, okay. If they just continued with their regular work.
I mean, yeah, that sounds good then. That's so fascinating. And I mean, that just goes to show, because like I said, my majority of my knowledge about gladiators comes from Hollywood, those sorts of things. But I mean, in terms of the broader topic of kind of ancient Rome, I mean, you said that was what sort of first sparked your interest, was you were already interested in ancient Rome. But how well known is the topic of gladiatorial fighting within that kind of broader topic? Because ancient Rome's such a big thing. Loads of people are obsessed with, I mean, you know, they say, oh, it's the ancient Rome, right? You think about it at least once a day. But how well known is this topic of gladiators within that, would you say?
Yeah, there are still many misconceptions about it, especially triggered by those Hollywood movies.
Yes.
And there were... In those movies, they always show those mass fights, that there are like thousands of people in the arena fighting. Everyone fights against each other or something. Yeah. There were mass fights of the in the gladiatorial time, but then it was also, it wasn't that common.
Yeah.
And it was mostly, maybe beginner gladiators or something. And then, of course, they fought within their own equipment only. An opponent.
Yes, you were saying the appropriate role.
Appropriate opponent. There is one source mentioning five Secutores against five Retiari.
Okay.
But
they have to be against those roles.
One Retiarius, last man standing, and he eventually won and also finished off the remaining Secutores.
I mean, if you don't do it properly.
Also, what they mix a lot is the fights against another man or woman, human, and animals. Like when we remember this famous scene from the first Gladiator movie, he was fighting this gladiator called Tigris, and then also tigers popped up into the area. And that's something, either you were an animal fighter who also had to train that, So it was also the same profession, and they only fought against animals.
Okay, so it did exist, but it was just a specialized thing.
It was the morning program.
Okay.
So when you have like the full
the
day of it, since Emperor Augustus, he kind of restructured the whole thing. He put in the morning the animal fights. It could have been animal against animal,
okay,
or animal against the trained animal fighter, the Venator.
Oh, okay.
Around noontime, it was the executions, which could have been very
just
fancy.
A nice fun pause, lunch break.
It wasn't only Christians. The Christians were really a minority. That's another of those misconceptions. And then in the afternoon, it was the highlight, the gladiator fights. And of course, I think there you also had building up a kind of, a plot line that you begin with the newbies who had their first fight and really the big stars, they were at the end.
Okay.
So a boxing fight night, what you have today.
Yeah, well, or even like I'm thinking I used to do competitive swimming a lot and you'd always start. The first heats were always the slower swimmers, you know, and you'd start with the young ones and then you'd get older and then you'd get faster. So you wanted to hang around until the end with to watch the stars.
Exactly,
Okay, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, and gladiators could become really stars, like now our sports stars today.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned that they had meals, they had food, they had, you know, room, accommodation, they had medical. Did they also get paid or was it just sort of paid in food and board?
They could. The Lannister, the owner of the gladiator school, who you could compare to like a manager of a sports club today, he rented out his gladiators to the person who wanted to give a gladiator show to the people.
Okay.
In Rome, it was, in the imperial time, it was really mostly the emperor, or you had to ask the emperor if you're allowed to put on a show.
Okay.
In the provinces, it was sometimes required with your office to give either chariot races, theater shows, gladiator shows, whatnot.
Yeah.
So they had to, those people organizing a show, they had to rent the gladiators from the Lannister and he hired them out for a certain price. And if the gladiator who won might have also gotten a prize money, which he partially might have received and maybe another portion, the Lannister, of course, kept for covering his costs of housing and feeding and training the gladiators.
Right, so it's kind of the profits rather than the full amount.
But they could keep some of it for themselves. And that was also maybe, especially if you became very famous, maybe a reason, especially from the lower classes, to proceed a career as a gladiator.
To
earn some money and then maybe paying off debts which you had or proceed afterwards with a better life than before or something.
Okay. Because, I mean, that's also one of the kind of Hollywood stereotypes is that gladiators, if they're slaves as well, you can sort of win your freedom almost or kind of buy your way out.
Of,
so is, could that have happened?
Yes.
Okay.
But most important, you could be released from, of course, fighting as a gladiator and receiving, it's called wudis. It's not really clear if it's really a wooden sword or if it's just a stick and what was on it in ancient times, because none of these things really have been found. It's a little bit different than with the military diplomas, where you really found military diplomas and know how, what they look like.
Yeah.
But with the wudis, we only have the word. We did it now or do it nowadays with our gladiator groups that it's kind of a wooden sword, resembling a little bit of a training sword with your name engraved in it.
Okay.
So I just received mine.
I was about to say, do you have one?
Yeah, I do. And but with the misconceptions, we have a very famous one, which I didn't talk about yet. That's thumbs up and thumbs down.
Yes, I've heard that that is not actually the case.
Yes.
So where does that come from then?
It comes from two texts where one is Juvenal and the other is Prudentius, where they mention something like pollice verso, that means like turned thumb. But it's not clear in which direction the thumb is turned.
Okay.
And I try to like analyze all the hand signals in an article I wrote about it, which were there in the arena at a gladiator fight. The gladiator had to give or could give the sign of surrender. That's like he's sticking up his index finger and dropping his shield and holding up his index finger and saying, hey, I cannot fight any longer. Then, of course, the referee needs to make a sign. Then the referee needs to look at the editor, the giver of the games, the organizer of the games, emperor or the local magistrate, and has to look at him for his signal. And yeah, the thumbs up, thumbs down, he didn't do. And especially remembering a gladiator and a referee, they are standing in the middle of the arena, which sometimes is nearly, not nearly as big as a soccer field, a little bit smaller, but still.
Still big,
The emperor is sitting above in his box, of course, in the first row, but but it's still like kind of a long distance and no.
It's hard to see
like
a thumb. So
it had to be two really different signs.
Yeah. Maybe with flags, like.
Yes. Either it could have been one sign could have been something with the hand and the other one could have been something with waving piece of cloth or something. Yeah. They most people had a mappa with them. Piece of cloth where they could wrap up their food and whatsoever.
Like a handkerchief.
A huge handkerchief.
I've learned so much already. I think we're running a bit out of time with this particular tea break. We should probably get back to work. But don't worry, everyone listening, we're going to have another tea break in 2 weeks' time where I will be chatting further with Svenja all about gladiatorial training. I hope you've seen why we have this theme, by the way, seeing as we are. When this episode gets released, will be in January. Those of you looking to think of potentially, you know, new sport take on to get that those fitness goals for 2026 in line, you know, have a little think about it. You don't have to do thumbs down, thumbs up right now. But yeah, I hope that you enjoyed this tea break. If you did, please do like, follow, subscribe, etc. wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode or about Svenja's experience with reenactment, you can find all the relevant links and contact information in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.